Welcome to the Master Your Health podcast. My name is Amanda Rocchio, previously Amanda Meister. I am best known for my meal prep and nutrition content. And today I'm here with my co-host, the research junkie between the two of us, and my husband, Chris Rocchio.
Hello, everyone.
Today we're talking all about what's in your tap water. I do a big slurp and gulp of my water, but I'll save you that annoying sound. But before we get into today's episode, Chris is going to read a five-star review from one of our listeners.
Yeah, this one is from Strawberry Applesauce, titled A Good Variety of Guests / Info. I've really enjoyed the podcast so far. There is such a wide variety of guests and lots of information presented so listeners can make decisions for themselves. The podcast doesn't feel biased, and there are guests with some opposing views, but the hosts handle it well. Yeah, that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you so much for leaving that review. If you guys could take a moment and leave a review for Chris and I, it really helps keep the momentum going and get the word out about our podcast.
Yeah, definitely. And today we're talking about what's in your tap water. And this can be a rather extensive topic, so we're going to go through most of the most pressing matters concerning this area. And there's some contention in this topic in general, so we'll let you know where we side on things, and we'll also give you some action points at the end to kind of correct some things and to avoid some of these toxins in our tap water, some of these contaminants that we know that are in there, and we'd like to hear what you think about it at the end.
Yeah, I mean, because we're pretty much just walking vessels of water. No, I'm just kidding. It's not that simple, but so much of us is composed of water, so it's really important to pay attention to where you're getting your water, how you're filtering it. And we're really going to explain today why we think you should do that.
Yeah, because since the Industrial Revolution, you know, the global population has been exposed to like thousands of toxins. And some of them are banned and some are still in use despite some contention in the scientific community over whether these substances are harmful and at what amounts they're harmful. And you can see this when you compare the safe levels allowed by the FDA to that of other agencies around the world, like in Europe or Asia, because there are some substances that are allowed and still tolerated by U.S. regulatory forces that are banned in other countries. And,
wow.
There are still certain levels allowed in our country that are not allowed in other countries.
That's really interesting. Is that kind of why you think, you know, when you go over to Europe, I usually hear in certain parts of Europe, it's safer to drink the tap water. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more encouraged. I think in Austria was one of the places.
Yeah. It's like less fluoride, less chlorine, things like that.
Yeah.
And these things, fluoride and chlorine, they obviously have the benefits. I mean, obviously of the decontamination, the dental help. But we're going to go through some of the adverse effects that have been shown in the last 10, 15 years and why we think you should be questioning this and why we think you should be filtering your water. So there's this agency called the Environmental Working Group, and there are certain groups that actually oppose the way that Environmental Working Group operates and the way that they handle the arguments. And this is because the Environmental Working Group has a much more strict criteria through which they filter and evaluate and analyze all of this information than most government agencies and things like that. And this is because traditional toxicity studies, they aim to find these two specific measurements. So there's the lowest observed adverse effect level and the no observed adverse effect level. And what they do is they find the level of a toxin that would give you a adverse side effect. And then they experimentally lower that until they observe no more toxic effects. But these studies usually test for like cancer and mortality, and they ignore the fact that small doses can lead to endocrine disruption and immunotoxicity, which they largely overlook.
Also, I mean, it's a good reminder, and I think some of our friends have said this to us, our naturopathic doctor friends, that these toxins don't happen in a vacuum, right? Like, we're isolating the toxins in the studies, but we're being exposed to a ton of toxins. So wouldn't we want to watch our overall level and have it lower than in these studies? Because we're not just getting one of these toxins. We're exposed to such an array in today's environment. And also another issue with some of these studies is that they assume that every human is going to respond the same. But we know from looking at a variety of other studies that that's definitely not the case.
Right.
Like, for example, a diabetic may react differently than someone with a healthy metabolism. Same thing with the elderly population versus maybe a younger adult. So the Environmental Working Group reported that the average person carries 91 toxic chemicals in his or her blood and urine. Another Environmental Working Group study found 232 different toxins in the umbilical cord of 10 newborn babies. Wow, that's pretty crazy. And some of this stuff inevitably ends up in our water supply. So the Environmental Working Group has identified 316 contaminants in the public water supply, 202 which are unregulated. In our city, which is Los Angeles, there are 8 contaminants that exceed the EWG health guideline, like arsenic, bromate, uranium, nitrate, and a handful of others. So low doses of toxins can be harmful over time, as some of them accumulate more and more than others. And this is also why it'd be more of an issue if you're not, you know, urinating properly, you're not a sweater. These are all different ways that we can kind of excrete these toxins. And so if you're having issues with that, that's going to be a bigger issue.
Yeah, it's the body's natural detoxing process has a lot to do with the nutrients that you have, you know, your water consumption and things like that. Usually sweating only applies to certain heavy metals and like BPA. So there's a lot of people who think that when you sweat, you're sweating out all toxins, but that's not the way that the toxic elimination process occurs in our body. But yes, sweating does help with that. And you guys got to understand that it's kind of like the analogy that you hear a lot when you're hearing about toxins, is that you have the bathtub, the faucet, and the drain. And the faucet is the toxins being in your environment and thus accumulating in your body. The bathtub is your overall accumulation of toxins, and the drain is the detox, essentially. And so if there's more coming out of the faucet than what's draining out of the drain, there's going to be a bioaccumulation. So that's kind of the approach that we're taking here, as opposed to like looking at it and saying in a vacuum, this dose of this substance can totally be safe in the human body. You don't know how this dose of this substance is reacting with a dose of another substance. You know, these kind of like the multiplier effect. There are a bunch of different variables, and a lot of times these individual studies that justify these accepted levels with the FDA, they are looking at it through a univariate fallacy.
Well, the good news here too is that the human body is really resilient. We're resilient creatures. But this podcast is all about making sure you're optimal. So we're trying to really help you optimize and give you the best health content, not just, hey, what's safe to get by in life, but hey, you know, maybe pay attention to all these things because they can cause some issues. Yeah, maybe it's not super severe, but enough to cause some health issues. And we're all about optimizing.
Right. And like we said many times before, we like to give you this information to let you deal with it on your own and make your own informed decisions. Obviously, the standard of living has never been higher, and the life expectancy and longevity in modern medicine and the decontaminants that come with, you know, chlorinated water and getting rid of the pathogens that could be in the water supply. Obviously, that stuff is it's crucial. We're not Luddites here, and we're not speaking against technology in general, but some technological advances do have externalities, so to speak, and those externalities have some negative health consequences on the populations.
Right. I mean, it is great news that we can come here. We don't have to be super scared about drinking the tap water. You know, you're out of your water bottle or you don't have a water filter. You know, it's nice that in a lot of places in the U.S., it's not that big a deal. Like, okay, you have some tap water, you're going to be fine. Unlike some other countries you go to and you're like, absolutely do not drink the tap water. You might get really sick that day.
We also have aging water infrastructure systems in some of these older cities. You know, I mean, obviously the most well-known one in the U.S. is Detroit, because they were dealing with the lead and all the contaminants in the water there. And I don't think they've even fixed that, even though that was like 10 years ago.
Yikes.
But yeah, we just like you to be aware of all this stuff, and you can make your own decisions. We're by all means not telling you to, like, you know, you have to avoid tap water like the plague, because, you know, sometimes I still drink tap water. But when I can, you know, we use filter on our showers, filter on our water that we drink, and we just try to avoid it whenever possible. So we're going to get into the reasons why we avoid this, because there's a list of contaminants in the water and list of negative effects. And basically, you guys can make your own decisions. So the things in our water supply are known as anthropogenic contaminants, and they can impose a variety of different risks, and some of them reproductive, some of them hormonal, some of them affecting the immune system. Most of these compounds are known to be endocrine disrupting chemicals. Those are EDCs, and they can impact your endocrine system and subsequently impair the development and fertility of humans and animals. And the source of this chemical contamination in water is diverse. I mean, some of them originate from byproducts formed during the water disinfection process. Some of them are released from industry and livestock activity. You also have therapeutic drugs released into the sewage. There's a whole list of them. I mean, other EDCs in the water, such as like disinfection byproducts, fluorinated compounds, bisphenol A, phthalates, pesticides, and natural and synthetic estrogens. And all of these have adverse reproductive effects in animals and humans. And obviously humans are animals, but from the sake of talking about
the studies.
I love
how in our notes we have non-human animals and humans, but I guess that's just really the science technical term.
That's how the studies refer to them because, you know, when you have these meta studies, they analyze both non-human animals and humans. And there's, you know, because there's different ones that are talking about rodents and other ones specifically in humans. And so you have to make that distinction. But anyway, when we're talking about these adverse reproductive effects, we're talking about impairing development, fertility, and even other bodily systems.
I mean, which obviously you can see today on the rise, fertility issues becoming more and more an issue, which there's so many different factors to that. I know, you know, parents are having children at older and older in age, but one of the reasons could also be a lot of these environmental toxins, some of which are in our water. So that's just something to consider and more motivation to really filter your water and make sure you're choosing good sources. So first on our list, we wanted to talk about the disinfecting products that are used in our water and why, yes, on one hand, they can be helpful, but on the other hand, you don't want to be consuming too much of them. So like we said earlier, chlorine reduces incidence of waterborne diseases, and that also has contributed to an increased life expectancy. Mm-hmm. But there's some drawback to the use of the high amounts of chlorine in our water. Unfortunately, as a result of the treatment of chlorine on our water, you get compounds in the water that are known as disinfection byproducts, so DBPs. Things like chlorine and chloramine, you know, lead to DBPs. And this becomes a health concern in humans. There's increased risk of bladder, kidney, and rectal cancers. There's an increased risk of reproductive problems like birth defects and low birth weight. Chlorine and chloramine vapors are associated with a greater risk of asthma and may damage, you know, part of the respiratory tract. And also chlorine is such a powerful antimicrobial agent and is effective in killing many different strains of bacteria that has been shown to alter the gut microbiome. You know, we've talked about this a lot and how important it is to have a diverse, you know, microbiome in your gut. And chlorine is one of those agents that could actually negatively impact your diverse microbiome.
Well, the one thing that I think is really odd here is that for as long as we've been chlorinating the water, there's very few, if not, I mean, I was not able to find a conclusive study in humans about the microbial effects of chlorinated water in humans. I mean, you can find it in mice, and there is a study that shows that there's an altering of bacteria diversity in mice and in rodents, but that has not been mimicked conclusively in humans, which is, I don't know, it seems kind of negligent that you'd have this for a long time. We know that, like you said, that chlorine is known to kill several different strains of bacteria. How do we just assume that it's not killing the bacteria once it hits our gut? So, I mean, I'm just baffled.
That assumption myself, right? Though. I don't need to see a human study. I mean, I just, my conclusion would be consuming too much would definitely negatively impact your microbiome.
Right. So, yeah, that's my main thing is that, like, I mean, unfortunately, we do live in the world where I like to see studies, but I'm able to use deductive reasoning to err on the side of caution while the scientific community catches up to this. And that's just the way I think. I'm not projecting that onto anybody else and saying that, you know, you should do the same, but that's one of the reasons why I err on the side of caution. But yeah, so she was talking about the formation of these disinfection byproducts, and there are certain factors that contribute to it, you know, that because it's most of the time it's these chemicals reacting with other chemicals in the water, like I was talking about before. So like you said, we may study the effects of chlorine and you know, the amount at which there are no adverse effects, but do we study them in conjunction or in combination with all the other things they come in contact with? So one of them is organic matter in the water that meets certain compounds in the soil, such as bromide or iodine. And one of the most common forms of these THMs, which are these byproducts, is a compound called chloroform, which is a known carcinogen. And these compounds are toxic when consumed, inhaled, or applied to the skin. Another thing that contributes to this is higher temperatures and low pH of the water and the concentration of the disinfectant agent. Like chlorine, for example, has the highest potential to form disinfectant byproducts when compared to like chloramine or chlorine dioxide. And most people are exposed to these DBPs by consuming it, but inhalation and dermal absorption through the skin can occur during like showers, baths, swimming pools, steam rooms, sitting in the hot tub, things like that. So it's not just ingesting these things that they can get into your system.
Right. I know. I always wondered because I was a swimmer back in the day. And I remember like you just get worried. You get worried about your hair, all that stuff. So that always concerned me a little bit.
You can just smell it on you. When you go to those public pools, it's not so much the home pools like the personal ones in the backyard, but public pools. I mean, you feel like you're just caked in chlorine after you're done. You dry off. You can smell it on your skin afterwards. It's just crazy.
So, I mean, they got to add something to get rid of the little kids pee in the pool, though, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, honestly, if I had a choice between one or the other, but unfortunately, you're getting both. So there are over 700 DBPs that have been identified, but only 11 are regulated by the EPA. And as far as effects on non-human mammals, researchers have reported developmental toxicity and genotoxicity. They've also seen disruption in ovarian function and the creation of sperm. And so obviously these things lead to negative fertility outcomes. And in humans, it's been shown to be associated with adverse reproductive outcomes in women and men, associated with reduced birth rate, associated with decreased sperm motility, decreased sperm concentration, and decreased serum testosterone in men. And two things to keep in mind with these studies is that one, some of them are association studies. So there could be other factors that are contributing. We always throw out that disclaimer. And two, there are also null studies on these compounds, meaning that some studies have not found these associations. But nonetheless, we err on the side of caution until the scientific community can sort that out.
Yep, totally. So moving on, there's also estrogens found in our water. So both natural and synthetic forms of estrogen are in the environment. Both forms can act as endocrine disruptors that can alter steroid signaling from our sex organs by interacting with estrogen receptors. Now, there are natural estrogens that are produced by humans like estradiol and estriol, but there are also phytoestrogens in plants and certain estrogen-mimicking compounds that result from industrial activity and modern food distribution. All of these can disrupt the endocrine system, impair reproductive function, and trigger adverse health effects. So, you know, estrogen for both men and women can cause issues.
Yeah, I mean, negative health effects in humans concerning reproductive health. You have exposure to exogenous estrogens that have been associated with increased risk of breast cancer in women in Spain. And also urinary phytoestrogen levels were associated with infertility in men in China. So that alone should make anybody fearful. I mean, whether or not you want to have kids, like you still don't want your sex hormones or your reproductive health being messed with, right?
Yeah, I also think this is why estrogen does get a bad rap, and we want to make sure that, you know, it is a hormone that serves a lot of positive functions in our body, but there's just so many different types of, you know, natural forms and unnatural forms of estrogen, like I said earlier. So you do want to be careful with this compound.
Right. All right. And real quick, I wanted to go through the source of this so you guys can make informed decisions and try to avoid this stuff. So one of the main sources of this is the cattle industry, because they use growth-enhancing steroids. And this is why Amanda and I choose organic pasture-raised meat to try to avoid that. And sometimes,
wow, I didn't even know that was... That's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely. And water has also been polluted with estrogens released from sewage plants. And in humans, pregnant women excrete high levels of three different types of estrogens. So, I mean, that's estriol, estradiol, and estrone. So, you know, just pregnant women urinating can add estrogens to the public water supply, which is crazy because they don't always get filtered out completely. And you also have a certain estrogen from birth control pills that get put in the water supply. I mean, most people think that this is a large source of the estrogen through either people taking birth control pills and peeing them out or flushing them down the toilet. But this is actually a much lower level than most people previously thought. And so you're actually getting much more estrogen from, like I said, pregnant women peeing in the water supply than you would from birth control pills. So
blame all the pregnant women. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm just saying I'm making comparison because many times people, when talking about estrogen in the water supply, they think birth control pills, right? But that's has shown to be relatively small compared to the other sources of contaminants.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's an important reminder. It's like you can control your water filter at home. I mean, obviously, depending on what budget you have, you would have to get a different one depending on your budget. But it's just more the reason because, you know, they're probably trying the best they can to filter our water. But in my mind, I'm going to give it a little early. It's not good enough.
No, absolutely. I agree.
So another compound of concern in our water is BPA, which is widely used in manufacturing plastics for industrial use and used in obviously food and beverage packaging. Sources for BPA include, you know, your diet, and it's also in the environment, in the air, in the dust, in the water. I mean, there's BPA everywhere. So it can leach into the food from many of these plastic coatings and from the canned goods. It's also in tableware, food storage containers, water bottles, and baby bottles. So this is also something to consider when you're picking out a baby bottle. So keep in mind, these things are used in food and drinking packages, water and infant bottles, compact discs. I didn't even think about that. Safety equipment, medical devices. And it's used to coat metal products like food cans, bottle tops, and water supply pipes. So it's really everywhere.
Yeah, like we said, it's ubiquitous. And it's so harmful because BPA has the ability to bind membrane and nuclear receptors such as androgen, estrogen, and thyroreceptors. And this potentially causes endocrine disruption, tumors, adverse reproduction outcomes, and transgenerational effects. So like they can be passed on to your offspring, essentially. And Canada was the first country to prohibit the sale and imports of BPA-containing baby bottles. So that's a beautiful thing. The U.S. needs to follow suit on that. Several states in the U.S. banned the use of BPA in cups, bottles, thermoses, baby food, and infant formula containers. France did something similar with its food packaging, but the FDA still deems it safe at current levels. But nonetheless, numerous studies have shown it to be a clear endocrine disruptor, even at low doses. I mean, it's associated with impaired and adverse reproductive function in men and women, and this includes decreased sperm concentration, reduced sperm quality, decreased antioxidant levels, reduced sperm DNA integrity, decreased motility, and increased percentage of immature sperm. And in a recent study, serum BPA concentrations were higher in women diagnosed with polycystic ovarian syndrome compared to women in healthy groups.
Wow.
So again, association study, want to throw that out there, but those things usually lead to more rigorous placebo-controlled studies. So it's pretty clear that BPA is a reproductive toxin in both animals and in humans. And so for that reason, industry has shifted over to these BPA alternatives because they know that BPA is a buzzword and most people know about it. If you don't know the scientific effects, you at least know that it's bad and that you should avoid it. But some of these compounds that have been used as alternatives have been identified as toxins with similar negative effects. And these are things like BPE, BPF, and BPS.
Watch them just like really change the name because they're like, oh, now they're catching on to the BP. Yeah. They're just going to flip it upside down.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've also seen DE, HP free bottles as well, which you should look out for as well. But sometimes that's a buzzword too, to avoid the alternative coating that they're using in the plastic. So it's just a reminder that just because it says BPA free doesn't mean it doesn't have these negative health effects. You got to really look into like what the type of plastic is, which you can usually look with the number that's inside that recycle symbol on the plastic. And then from there, you can kind of deduce or figure out how they manufacture that plastic and how it's coated. And just to show you the mechanism why, you know, you have the reduced fertility in mammals is that you have these altering levels of sex steroid hormones. And, you know, it may be very slow over time, but, you know, you start looking at these comparisons to testosterone levels in men 60 years ago compared to testosterone levels in men now. Same thing with estrogen levels in men versus estrogen 60 years ago. I mean, it's insane. And this stuff is our clear variables in that equation.
Wow, it's really crazy.
I know.
So ways to avoid BPA, first of all, filter your water, which we'll get to at the end of this episode. We'll get to some suggestions on what we think you can use to filter your water or like what some of the best choices are. Also, don't take paper receipts at the store. I remember when I check out at CVS, you end up with a receipt that's pretty much as long as one of my blinds. You could just hang it as a replacement. And also, it's better for the environment. So ask for your paper receipts to be emailed to you. Also keep, if you do have plastic in the household, so we still have some old meal prep plastic containers or like we like to use when we're traveling. We mostly switched over to glass, but don't use these plastic ones in the dishwasher, in the freezer, in microwaves, because hot and cold temperatures can release more of these phthalates. So really try to avoid temperature changes when it comes to your plastic containers. Also avoid canned soda or BPA lined goods. Another tip for parents out there is to use wooden toys as much as possible instead of plastic toys for kids. Also, you can brew your coffee in glass rather than the plastic machines. I don't know. What's the one that you like to use, Chris?
Some people will say French press, but I personally hate French press coffee. I mean, you can do it because you can buy glass ones and it's pretty easy. It's not as tedious. I personally like the pour over, the Chemex, or there's Chemex off brands that, cost maybe a third of the price, but have the same essential shape. And I like that a lot. I mean, it's like I said, it's a little bit more tedious because you're manually pouring the water over the filter and over everything. And you have to kind of measure out the water and the coffee even more so to get the right ratio to make it taste good or whatever. But to me, that's just, I don't know, if I'm going to have coffee every morning and it's going to be the start of my day, I'm going to do it right. So that's one of my main things, is that either do the French press or the pour over.
There's an art to coffee. Chris makes some really good coffee, though. I appreciate it when he makes me a cup in the morning. Another thing you can do is use parchment paper or beeswax instead of plastic wrap, when you're, covering a container. You can also use stainless steel or glass for water bottles and food storage. And also when I can, I know it might be a little bit pricier, but if I need a water bottle from Whole Foods, they actually do have glass options instead of plastic. So that's another option for you. Again, it's not about being perfect. I'm not perfect. I tell you, I use plastic when I'm traveling. If I'm out and about and there's some fruit being sold and that's my only healthy option for a snack, but it comes in plastic, I'm not going to freak out. I'm just going to use it. But as much as I can at home, we really use glass containers, stainless steel, all that stuff. And like I said, filter your water source.
Yeah. All right. And the next topic we're going to talk about is phthalates. And phthalates are like plasticizers, lubricants, solvents, and they're used in a number of different industries. And they're commonly found in like food storage containers, single and reusable water bottles, children's toys, PVC products, like PVC products like in construction materials and in clothing. And there's also a large amount of it used in medical equipment, such as intravenous tubing and transfusion bags. And obviously that stuff is holding certain liquids that are going into your body. So it definitely gets into your system by being in those bags. And they're ubiquitously used in cosmetics and personal care products, such as makeup or perfumes, things like that. They're also in pharmaceuticals and adhesives, and they can easily leach out and contaminate both the individual exposed to them and the environment, like soil, water. And they can actually build up and accumulate in the environment because they're what's known as relatively stable, means they don't break down in the natural environment. So they can stay there, they can accumulate. And they can enter drinking water from either industrial runoff or from leaching from plastic food packages and plastic water bottles. So that's a major issue. And most single-use water bottles are made of a compound called PET, that's polyethylene terephthalate. And this compound is used because it's cheap. There's no other reason. It's just cheap and it can reduce manufacturing costs. So the convenience of having these disposable water bottles at our disposal is a major source of this contamination. And one of the things that breaks down this plastic is heat and light exposure. So whether or not you're sitting in a fluorescent light at room temperature or it's sitting in your hot car, that's going to create an increased rate of leaching into the water. So I remember back in the day when I heard this, I'd be so mad at myself because I would leave a huge bottle of water in the car and I'd just throw it out. I would not use it afterwards. So I was pretty disciplined about that.
Yeah. Now I just think about, at the end of the day, as women, all the makeup we wash off into the sink and how many phthalates that are in that, which is great. I'm glad, the beauty industry is having a huge shift and there's more and more natural products coming out, not just for what's on your skin, but the fact that it gets into our environment so easily. It's, the full cycle.
Right. And, just like everything else in this list, they are recognized as reproductive toxicants. So they can mess with our endocrine systems in both males and females. And there are epidemiological studies that have identified associations between, let's just say the phthalate levels measured in women's urine. And they also measure metabolite levels of these phthalates in pregnant women. And they have been associated with increased anogenital distance in boys. And so that's the distance between the anus and the scrotum. And that anogenital distance in boys, or the increased AGD in boys, is an indicator of reproductive toxicity, right? And this is because the AGD is under hormonal influence during fetal development. So summary is that you have high levels of phthalates detected in pregnant women. And that influences this distance between the scrotum and the anus between the boys, which is an indicator of reproductive toxicity. And multiple studies have demonstrated a shorter AGD in males exposed to environmental anti-androgens. And just so you know, androgens are steroid hormones like testosterone, and they play a role in the development of male reproductive traits and reproductive activity. But females have it too, but albeit at lower levels. So urinary concentrations of phthalates have an inverse associated with sperm concentration, sperm motility, and testosterone levels. And just inverse association means that as phthalate levels go up, these markers go down. That's all that means. Some phthalate compounds can also lead to increased testosterone and or progesterone in prepubescent girls. So that's another thing, is that, you know, it's not just testosterone levels going down in men, it's going up in women. And phthalate exposure in general is associated with adverse reproductive outcomes throughout a woman's lifetime.
Right. Basically, if phthalates weren't on your list of something to look out for, definitely keep an eye out for it. I think it's going to become a buzzword too, phthalate-free products.
I just wish you could pronounce it a lot better. It's like P-H-T-H, you know, it's like not the easiest beginning of a word.
So moving on to another compound that can be found in our water system is pesticides. So prior to the 1940s, elements such as arsenic, mercury, copper, and lead were used in pest management. Due to low water solubility, their accumulation in water was really not a concern. Synthetic organic pesticides were introduced during World War II, and since then, the United States Geological Survey estimates that 1 billion pounds of pesticides are applied annually to agriculture land, non-crop land, and urban areas in the United States. Let me say that one more time. 1 billion pounds of pesticides. Drinking water, which is sourced from either groundwater or surface water, is a potent vehicle of exposure to pesticides for both human and animals. So even the Netherlands National Institute of Public Health and Environmental Protection concluded that groundwater is threatened by pesticides in all European states.
Yeah, Europe is much further along in terms of recognizing the potential adverse effects of pesticides in the U.S. And I think that a lot of it has to do with Monsanto's huge, large amount of power over the FDA and USDA and things like that. I mean, I remember an ex-Monsanto lawyer was a FDA was the head of the FDA at one point. So I think you have the revolving door between private industry and regulatory agencies in this country is a huge reason why, in my belief, why this stuff is allowed here and not in other countries.
The good news is there's the things that we can personally control. So that's why we really want to empower you today. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to go through a couple common sources of pesticides. So obviously with pesticides, they're being sprayed on crops. So that's why, you know, organic can be a better choice, or you can also follow the Clean 15 Dirty Dozen list. If you don't want to spend all your money on organic, you can look that up. Now, organic produce isn't pesticide-free, but it does use more natural version of pesticides. So pesticides are also added to waterways such as canals, rivers, lakes, and streams to control mosquitoes, weeds, and invasive fish. Disinfectant pesticides are used in water treatment plants to remove bacterial and viral contamination from drinking water. They are also applied to water used in large-scale irrigation systems, especially in humid and tropical climates. This is done to protect crops from infestations as well as humans from contracting vector-borne diseases such as malaria. So according to the US EPA, pesticides applied to farms, gardens, and lawns run off into the ground and surface water systems that feed drinking water supplies in both agriculture and urban settings. So there's this runoff effect. There are also spills and illegal disposals on record, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
The point sources of pesticide contamination include pesticide manufacturing plants, mixing and loading facilities, spills, waste disposal sites, sewage treatment plants, and waste water recharge facilities such as wells and basin. Pesticides can also seep into and through the soil and end up in aquifers.
Yeah, something about like tainting the aquifers, you know, in our modern civilization really bothers me. Whether we're tapping into it to like feed the water fountains and golf courses in Palm Springs, or whether we're poisoning it with fracking, like the fact that we're messing with this ancient backup water systems that we could possibly use in a, you know, like severe droughts and things like that in the future, and we use them for, we contaminate them, we don't care about them. It just, it really just you know, rubs me wrong.
What do you think the solution is? Because you know what, like going through all that, it did make me realize how much we need pesticides. Is it using more of the natural versions like we do on organic crops and all that, basically?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And not only that, but what's even crazier is that some pesticides are even capable of moving in the air from their point of application to very distant surface water reservoirs. I mean, there's also been organic farms that have been contaminated by pesticides that carry over from, you know, from sprayed farms. So there's certain things like that you have some externalities from the use of them as well. And of all the herbicides, pesticides, and fungicides, among those three, herbicides are the most prevalent in terms of contamination in the drinking water in all three in the United States, Europe, and in Asia. And so after herbicides, insecticides are the second most commonly detected pesticide, and that's detected in drinking water and drinking water sources. And there are several effects that pesticides have over human health. I mean, it's kind of crazy. There's been several different lawsuits linking, you know, payouts from Monsanto, like with glyphosate, to cancer development and people that have worked either with it or around it perpetually for like years, right? And I mean, multi-million dollar, $10 million settlements, things like that. So obviously there is a link to cancer, and there are legal arguments that prove that, but why do we not see this in the medical literature or the academic literature? It's kind of weird. Like, how are you going to prove that in a court of law without there being any peer-reviewed research to prove it? It seems to me that there's
super sketchy. Although I'm sure when you work with it, they obviously claim that you're at such high amounts, so that is the difference. But I still think, you know, if you're working with it and you're seeing those adverse effects, you know, in small amounts, my question would be like, what are those adverse effects? Maybe it's not cancer, but maybe it's not good.
And not only that, but like, it's not like each piece of fruit or each piece of produce gets an equal amount of pesticides with their methods of spraying. So who's to say that, you know, one area of crop tested doesn't have a larger concentration of the pesticide or herbicide than the other? I mean, there are so many different variables. To me, this is another one that's contentious, and that you have conflicting research and outcomes on both sides, and we are on the side of caution. But I digress. So the effects. So there are many pesticides and herbicides and different forms of them, and we're not going to go through all of them by name and specifically address each one's negative effects. We're just going to tell you the list of possible negative effects that have been shown in humans. So you have some negative reproductive outcomes in adults, like stunted in utero growth and low sperm count. And animal studies have also shown reproductive abnormalities, hormonal changes, decreased antioxidant capabilities, and immune system disruption. So, I mean, we really need to have many comprehensive studies in the future about the cumulative effects of these different pesticides, you know, on the endocrine system, the reproductive system, the immune system, the microbiome. And we also need to study the underlying mechanisms of the toxicity of pesticides. And I think that's crucial for understanding the toxic effects in both non-human animals and humans, because it affects both, because we're all in the environment, and developing appropriate strategies to, you know, reduce the risk of pesticide toxicity today.
Absolutely. Yeah, I definitely feel like there's not enough research, and, you know, we really should be focused on solutions in this area. And you know, realizing how connected the environment is and our health, you can't separate the two, and really taking that into consideration in all areas of life.
Right. And one thing that you can do, like, for instance, one of the most heavily sprayed crops in the world is coffee, right? But if you get coffee from high altitude regions, usually the pests that affect those regions, like the insects and stuff that are the biggest problem to crops, do not exist at these high altitudes. So if you look for high altitude organically grown coffee, that's probably the best way to do it. And so there's ways to go around it. And like I said, you know, you can go for organic crops. If you can't afford it, you can prioritize and use the ones. There's a list of, you know, like the Dirty Dozen, right? Where it's the 12 most highly sprayed crops on the planet. Let it on our regular food supply that's readily available to us at most grocery stores. So you can look at those, and you can look at the ones that are the least sprayed. So you can prioritize, like, let's just say you want to get your strawberries organic because that's one of the most heavily sprayed ones. But then you want to get, like, say, your spinach just normally, right? So that's going to depend on your budget and your own priorities as far as what, you know, where you want to spend your money. But there are ways around it, and there are ways to prioritize.
And this is just another reason, like we said, to filter your water because of these pesticides that are leaked into them.
Mm-hmm. And next on the list, we're going to talk about fluorinated substances because that's pretty much in every water supply in the U.S. And studies have reported that a couple of these fluoride-based compounds were responsible for impairing sperm viability in humans and non-human animals. So you can see a common denominator in all of these things. I mean, most of them are messing with reproductive health.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating that that seems to be the adverse the effect of all these. Yeah.
Right. And again, these fluorinated substances are just ubiquitous in the environment, highly persistent, and they're stable, so they stay there.
So we wanted to walk through some of the sources of these fluorinated substances. I'll also refer to a specific compound called PFAs. So first of all, one source is your drinking water. So this is why you want to look for a fluoride filter when it comes to your drinking water. Mm-hmm. Food packages also contain PFAs. Food grown in PFAs contaminated soil or water. Commercial household products, including stain and water repellent fabrics, which is pretty crazy. Nonstick pans, polishes, waxes, paints, cleaning products, and firefighting foams. PFAs can also be found in the workplace, including production facilities or industries that often use these compounds. They usually build up and persist over time inside of livestock too.
You know, what's crazy is that one of the major sources of groundwater contamination of these PFAS are the firefighting training drills. And because of, like I said, the firefighting foams. So a lot of them occur at like airports or military bases, and you have a lot of contamination around them because of the training that occurs there. So effects on humans, PFAS, and just so you guys know, in case you want to look it up, that stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. All right, just for your research.
Say that five times fast.
No. So they have longer half-lives in humans than in non-human animals, suggesting that humans could be more susceptible to toxicity than non-human animals, which is crazy. PFAs are also known to disrupt reproductive function in non-human animals. So you have the increased incidence of tumors, endocrine disruption, impaired neurodevelopment, and adverse reproductive and fertility outcomes in both humans and non-humans. And there are a series of studies that show these altered sperm concentrations, lower sperm motility, impaired sperm penetration, and lower total sperm count in adult men when you compare ones with, like, let's just say you compare a group of men with high levels of combined semen levels of these compounds with men, a group of men with low levels of concentration in their semen. So that's a pretty clear causal relationship right there. And PFAs may function as endocrine disruption chemicals to affect male genital development. So all in all, I mean, these chemicals and high concentrations of them were associated with reduced semen quality, reduced testicular volume, reduced penile length, and like we said before, the indicator with the anal genital distance in men. And in women, exposure to PFAs has been associated with endometriosis in U.S. and in China. And for those of you who don't know what endometriosis is, it's when you have this painful tissue that usually grows in the inside of the uterus, grows on the outside of the uterus, and creates all these types of adverse effects. So, and you also have these levels of PFAS in blood that have been associated with decreased serum levels of estradiol, which is a type of estrogen, progesterone, sex hormone binding globulin, follicle stimulating hormone, and testosterone. And lastly, with fluoride, even though that has received some pushback by the dental profession, a few studies have shown a link between prenatal fluoride exposure and reduction in IQ, which I'm not even trying to mess with. Whether or not they prove that wrong 5 years from now, that's fine. I hope they prove it wrong. But for right now, I'm not trying to roll the dice. And again, that's just our common theme behind this. While everybody else in the scientific community, they can quibble and fight over all this stuff, you know, we are going to take the precautions until they sort all that out amongst themselves. But I mean, no, like we said at the beginning, one of the common denominators in all of this is endocrine disruption. I mean, that's what you see, is that endocrine and reproductive function across the board. We don't even want to get into the cancer thing because there's so many different things and so many different levels and the contention between that. But just this alone is enough, because like we said, most of the levels set by the EPA and the FDA are set to prevent cancer, right? But they're not done to prevent these endocrine disruptions, you know, immunotoxicity, things like that. So that's one of the most important things we wanted to reiterate, you know, and each municipality has a different water treatment system and their supply of the water that they treat in order to get there. So the water will vary in terms of its quality depending on where you live. But the EWG, the Environmental Working Group, does have a database on its website. So you can go in and test water quality and judging by your zip code. And it'll go through and it'll tell you, like, for instance, like we said, we have 8 contaminants in our water, and it'll go through, give you the levels that it's that's detected in the water supply. It'll give you the levels accepted by government agencies, and then it'll give you the level that the Environmental Working Group suggests. And then you can go through the Environmental Working Group and you can show why, and they show why they think these certain chemicals at those dosages are harmful. So I would definitely look into that. There are other databases. I think each municipality does by law, has to disclose the water quality report. So you can look that up online. It's readily available. And it's important to reiterate that the EWG and government agencies have different acceptable levels of these contaminants due to the different methodologies when analyzing these studies. And so depending on where you lie in the spectrum, how much faith you have in certain agencies, that's what's going to determine your decision.
So that's why we want to lay out all this information and all the data so you can make your own informed decision. And while we're on the subject, we wanted to help give you some action steps to really reduce your total toxic load and exposure to all of the things we talked about in today's podcast. So I know on the podcast we talked about water supply, but in a larger content, we really want to reduce your overall exposure to toxins whenever possible. So not just in water, but in cosmetic, personal care products, home cleaning products, pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, and food. So really pay attention to the products you're purchasing and switch those over time. You know, you don't have to do it overnight, but slowly make that transition to cleaner, better products.
Yeah, definitely.
Next on the list would be to invest in a water filter. Mm-hmm. So I remember in college, everyone had the Brita water filter. That was like the only water filter you could have, right? There was no other answer. Mm-hmm. Then looking into the actual data on it, the Brita water filter is a little bit behind compared to a lot of these other water filters. So number one on our list is to make an investment in a carbon-based water filter. So that's why we actually have the Berkey water filter on hand. It's also a cute little thing. Like if you want a cute looking water filter, I don't know. I'm a little girly like that. I like aesthetic too. The important thing to remember with the Berkey water filter is to also get the add-on, the fluoride water filter, so it doesn't mm-hmm. come with that. I didn't know that at first. So Chris and I went back and bought the upsell of the fluoride water filter. We definitely think it's worth it. Another option is the reverse osmosis water filter. So those usually go underneath your sink. It's a great option. The only thing I don't like about that is you have to add in minerals. So you have to add in like some sea salt or some trace minerals, because the reverse osmosis strips the water of all the minerals, mm-hmm. Which is, you want to consume water with some minerals in it, or it can strip, you know, your body of some of those minerals.
Right.
Now, those options can be a little bit pricier. So if you're not there yet and you want something on the price level of the Brita water filter, one good product we found was the Zero water filter, which mm-hmm. filtered out a lot more than the Brita did. So get rid of your Brita and go to Amazon, get a Zero water filter. They're not expensive.
Yeah, it'll filter out everything as well. So that's another method where you have to reintroduce some minerals to it afterwards.
And also when it comes to purchasing water at the store, we highly suggest getting spring water, because that's naturally has minerals from running down the mountain. So that's one of the best options. We don't really suggest alkaline water and any of the others. So truly, really try to go for spring water. And we understand sometimes, you know, you're traveling, you'll have to get it in plastic, which is totally fine. It's about what you do most of the time, not what you do some of the time.
And what I used to do, I used to have, several different 1 gallon jugs or like a 3 gallon jug. You can go to most grocery stores will have reverse osmosis refilling machines outside. You can fill it either in 5 gallon jugs, 1 gallon jugs. So that's another option as well. I mean, it's a little bit more tedious because you got to carry that stuff to and from the car. But as far as I'm concerned, I mean, I did that for years because I had a smaller, you know, studio apartment when I first moved to LA. And so, that was how I got it. And it worked just fine.
Chris was on me about filling up our jugs at the gym, because my gym had this really nice filtration system. It was like reverse osmosis, but then it also added minerals back in. So he was like, fill up your glass gallon jug. Do not forget.
No, I'm still so pissed that Gold's Gym, even though it's been around forever, and you know they take in, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of high dollar membership fees every month and still cannot put a water filtration fountain in the place. I mean, it's like, it's one of the biggest things. Every time they send out the survey, like the satisfaction survey, I'm always like, put in a freaking water filtration system, you know, but it's like, I mean, it's one of the most successful gyms and they can't even afford that. But I think that's one of the most important things.
So next on our list for protecting yourself from these toxins in our environment is actually to eat a nutrient-dense diet. So certain nutrients help facilitate the body's natural detoxification process. So B vitamins, zinc, magnesium, choline, glycine, betaine, vitamin C, and glutathione. Plus, it gives the body the essentials for total optimization. So really eat a lot of whole foods and minimize those highly processed foods. I tell you guys that all the time, and I'm going to keep reminding you.
Right. Number three is improve gut health because some of these toxins wreak havoc on microbiome and intestinal lining. And the gut is terrific at removing ingested toxins. So you got to really take care of that and support it so it can do its job. And there are things like antibiotics, birth control, diets high in refined carbohydrates, industrial seed oils, chronic stress, chronic infections. All these things directly contribute to an unhealthy gut flora. So make sure you're addressing all of those things and make sure you're getting some prebiotics and resistant starch to feed the probiotics. And the way that you build up, the best way to build up your microbiome is by having a lot of different fiber and plant material into your diet, mostly veggies, have a wide variety of them, have fermented foods. And yeah, like we said, you make sure you're feeding it with prebiotics and resistant starch. And resistant starch is pretty much just cooked and cooled carbs. And potato starch is actually probably the highest concentration of resistant starch that you can do when you cook them and then cool them down and then eat them afterwards. The next thing is sweat. And this is another thing that most people get wrong, or like it's kind of a myth within the health industry, or health community, I should say, is that you can sweat out all toxins. But it's only certain toxins, like some heavy metals and BPA, you can sweat out. Not all can be eliminated through that that method. But, you know, like we said, it's important to jump in the sauna, get your daily or, regular workout, things like that.
I've also gotten pushback on this one because, you know, they say it's in small levels, but, you know, every little bit helps just because, you know, been shown in studies to be a small amount doesn't mean that that's beneficial to you.
Well, we're getting them in small amounts too. So, I mean, they're like with their argument when we're getting them in safe amounts is like, well, they're relatively small amounts. So, you know, I mean, I'm tired of hearing these double standards here.
I know it's tough, but anyways, a little fun fact about me is it's pretty hard for me to sweat.
Oh yeah.
Versus Chris sweats fairly easy. I think you're sweating right now.
I've been sweating since minute one.
But that's why I love using the sauna. I also love going to a hot yoga class. I'd actually complain to Chris that sometimes the hot yoga classes are not hot enough for me, which drives me crazy because I'm partially there to sweat. It feels good. I mean, you can tell when you get a good sweat session and then you take a nice shower. That's a good feeling, and I think that's for a reason.
Absolutely. Well, there you have it. We're excited to hear what you think about this. We can maybe go on a little bit further if you want to hear more. If you have some questions about us expanding on any of this material, by all means, reach out to us and let us know. We'll have the studies and all the relevant resources in the show notes, so you can check that out. And we're going to keep bringing you this content and keep hammering it out for you.
We'll catch you on the next one.
Yep. See you.
Bye.